Emily St. John Mandel. She's probably best known for her novel Station 11. It's set in the Great Lakes area before and after a pandemic. Station 11 was a finalist for a National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. It's been translated into 33 languages and was adapted into an HBO Max limited series. Emily's latest novel is called Sea of Tranquility, and it's just as powerful as Station 11. It's a beautifully written, compelling book filled with complicated characters that starts in 1912 and fast forwards to 2041. This expansive timeline gives Emily the chance to comment on our technology by considering the world without it. She also continues to build her Mandel cinematic universe by importing characters from her previous novels. My fellow British Columbian joined us from her book tour and explained why she wanted to explore time travel in Sea of Tranquility.
I've always really enjoyed time travel fiction. I love time travel film. You know, one of my very favorite movies is Rian Johnson's film, Looper. I don't know that I ever would have actually just gone for it and written a time travel novel if not for the pandemic. But I started this book in the spring of 2020, which in New York City was as horrifying as you might have gleaned from the New York Times reports. And there was something about the awfulness of that historical moment that just made me feel like, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. I'm just going to write whatever I want because the world's terrible. So that was the starting point for Sea of Tranquility. And once I realized that it was going to be a time travel novel, I feel like that's only fun, or it was only fun for me if I got to traverse an enormous amount of time.
Can you talk a little bit more about why you're kind of so fascinated by time travel?
I don't know what it is. I feel like maybe we're all a little bit fascinated by time travel. You know, something I've been thinking about lately, how do you explain the popularity of sites like Ancestry.com or 23andMe? If not some kind of desire to meet our ancestors. You know, I think we always want to go and see not just how the story ends, but also how the story begins. And that's certainly something that's always preoccupied me. You know, for me, when I read about different points in time, it's hard not to try to imagine what life would have been like in those moments. And in this book, I didn't go that far back. I went back to 1912, the character Edwin, who's loosely based on one of my great-grandfathers, who's always kind of been a source of fascination for me. He left London around 1908 or so, 18 years old, under the cloud of some unspecified scandal, and then had a really strange, rocky life in Canada and the United States because he just had no skills that would translate to the real world. You know, he was the recipient of this beautiful classical education, went to very exclusive schools, probably spoke Latin and Greek, but just had no idea how to make it in the world. And there was something always kind of interesting and poignant about that to me. So I knew I wanted to revisit that time period, and then I knew I wanted to go really far into the future as well.
You mentioned Edwin. He's one of three protagonists in your book. Another one of the protagonists is a writer named Olive Llewellyn, and she lives on the second moon colony, but is doing a book tour on Earth in 2203. She's written a best-selling novel about a pandemic, which is being turned into a movie. And this storyline seems to mirror your real-life experience with your previous novel, Station 11. How close to reality is it, aside from you not living on the moon?
Yeah, aside from that, it's very close in some ways, and not at all in others. The ways in which it's close, those were the first sections of the book that I started writing. And it was a couple of months before the pandemic broke out. And I'd been having this very specific experience for a number of years of having written a novel that was very successful, Station 11. And it just dealing with the ways which were mostly wonderful and which it had completely changed my life. And what I was thinking about is, you know, I feel such gratitude for this life. It feels incredible to me that I get to do this work. At the same time, people say such interesting things to me when I'm out on tour. And the word interesting is doing some heavy lifting in that sentence, by the way. So I'd wanted to write about these, frankly, quite surreal interactions that I'd had. Most interactions with readers are wonderful. It's one of the great pleasures of going out on the road. But man, that 1% is really something else. So yeah, I wanted to write about these interactions. And
yeah.
It seemed to me that maybe doing it in this kind of auto-fiction way, that's autobiographical fiction for any listeners who weren't familiar with the term. And what that term means is fiction that's just slightly more obviously based on the life of the writer. I think we always draw from our own lives in the fiction we write. Yeah, I wanted to write about the long tour experience. So every interaction that Olive has in this section is completely autobiographical. Those are things that people actually said to me on the road. It was kind of cathartic, I have to say, writing it down.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of one of the most surreal interactions that you've had on a book tour?
I remember I was in Texas, and a woman said to me, and just for context, my daughter was at home with my husband. A woman said to me, "You must have a very kind husband to look after your child while you do this." You know, I'm just going to go out on a limb and suggest that perhaps that's not a sentiment that male business travelers hear very often. You know, just that kind of thing where people would say things like that. And it was just this feeling of, wow, I'm literally speechless. You know, I'm out there providing for my family, but it's not always seen as such.
Yeah, that's a good example. Olive's novel is called Marion Bad, and I'm wondering, is this a reference to last year at Marion Bad, the Alain René film written by Elaine Robrier?
Only in the sense that I love the word Marion Bad, and that's where I came across
okay.
it. I've tried three times to watch that film, and it just won't stick.
Yeah, I thought there might be a connection beyond just you liking the word Marion Bad, which I like too, but because I see some similarities with the characters believing they've met each other before and kind of like the dreamlike vibe of the film, yeah.
Right.
Your first three novels were crime novels. Why did you decide to pursue a different genre with your fourth novel, Station 11?
I was afraid that I would get pigeonholed as a crime writer. And it's kind of a delicate point because I love crime fiction. And I really respect what it's so good. I really respect what crime writers do. They're better at plotting than anybody. Like, it's just really impressive. As a writer, though, once you get stuck in one of those marketing categories, it can be really hard to get out. And I was afraid that if I just kept on going in that genre indefinitely, that eventually I wouldn't be able to publish books in other genres. And also, I just had an interest in trying something completely different. So with Station 11, the original idea with that project was I wanted to write about a traveling Shakespearean theater company, and it was going to be set completely in the present day. It was not going to be apocalyptic at all. But I wanted to write about our technology, and I thought, well, maybe an interesting way to write about that would be to contemplate its absence. So I realized once I'd written this largely post-apocalyptic work that I had a book with a somewhat more commercial premise and that it was a very different genre. That was the book that completely changed my career.
I'm curious about how the success of Station 11 and the HBO series adaptation have affected you in terms of your writing. Did you feel more pressure when you started writing Sea of Tranquility?
I did. There was an intervening book. The real pressure I felt was The Glass Hotel, which came out 5 years after Station 11. That five-year gap is long for me. It used to take me about 2.5 years to write a book. This is the least sympathetic problem in the world, so I never talk about it. but yeah, you know, if you write a successful book, then all of a sudden there's this invisible audience looking over your shoulder as you work on the next book. And there was a feeling of pressure there that did probably slow down the writing of The Glass Hotel to a large extent.
Yeah, very well said. Characters from your 2020 novel, The Glass Hotel, appear in Sea of Tranquility. And one writer has coined the phrase the Mandel cinematic universe to describe your work. What do you think of that idea?
I love that phrase, and I appreciate you saying it on the air.
I think it's great.
I love that idea. Sometimes I just become attached to particular characters, and that's why Miranda and Leon from Station 11 are in The Glass Hotel. Sometimes I'll be writing a book, and I'll realize that for the point in time and the place I'm writing about, there are characters I can pull in from another book, and that's why there are three characters from The Glass Hotel in Sea of Tranquility. What's really been fun in the last few months is thinking about the multiverse in terms of TV, because for months it felt like a huge legal problem that there were Station 11 characters in the Glass Hotel, because then those characters are the property of Paramount Television. It becomes this whole sort of IP issue. But what I've been doing with Patrick Somerville and his colleagues who worked on the Station 11 show is making that more of a feature than a bug, and it's been really fun. So the Glass Hotel TV version will star Danielle Deadwyler, who gave that stunning performance as Miranda in Station 11. Yeah, you know, of all the performances on that show, I have to say Danielle Deadwyler and Himesh Patel really stand out for me. I just think they did brilliant work there.
You're absolutely right. They did. But besides time travel, you also explore the mind-bending idea that life is a simulation in Sea of Tranquility. Can you tell us a bit about this concept and how it developed as you were writing the book?
The problem with time travel narratives is they often fall apart under close scrutiny, because how do you travel back in time without creating a loop? So if I step into a time machine at the end of this interview and it takes me to Denver in 1910, wasn't I always going to step into a time machine and always go to Denver and then back, kind of around and around? And once you set up that loop, that's pretty disastrous in terms of cause and effect and free will, which is a problem when you're trying to develop fictional characters. You know, they've got to have some control. The only way that I could make time travel work for myself as a writer was by layering on this whole other level of weirdness, and that's the simulation hypothesis, which is this theory I came across years ago, you know, some internet rabbit hole moment. And it's what it sounds like. It's the idea that maybe all of reality is a simulation. What I love about it is you can find very intelligent people who will very convincingly argue either one side or the other. So for me, that was a way to make time travel work, is by layering on this whole other idea and having a character in the year 2401 by the time machine act as kind of an avatar for the skeptical reader, or maybe even the skeptical writer, and have that character say something like, "We don't quite understand why time travel works as well as it does. The fact that it works at all might be evidence that we're living in a simulation. You know, you have to go investigate." Yeah, the simulation hypothesis was just what I needed to bring in to make the story work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Near the end of your novel, Olive Llewellyn delivers a virtual lecture in the Hollow Space in 2203, and this is kind of like the idea of a Zoom meeting, but you've upgraded the technical side of it. And she tells her audience that she wants to consider the question of why there's been so much post-apocalyptic literature in recent times. And she's talking in 2203, but that also applies to our own time period here of 2022. Why do you think we're seeing so much apocalyptic literature in our times?
I gave all of my Station 11 lecture, which I delivered all over the United States up until I canceled the lecture on March 12th, 2020. So this is something I've thought about and talked about a lot. I come to the conclusion that Olive reaches in the book, which is it has to do, I believe, with a certain ambivalence about our technology. And to back up just a little bit, the theory that I've heard the most often is that it has to do with the anxiety we feel about the state of the world, and that a safe place to channel that anxiety is into reading apocalyptic fiction. The problem I have with that theory is, when have we ever believed that the world wasn't ending? And that is not to minimize the climate crisis or the other issues of our time in any way, just that I do believe we always think it's the end of the world, as far as I can tell. So then that raises the question, well, what has changed, you know, in the last span of 15 or so years that post-apocalyptic literature has been popular? And what's changed is our technology. We are available all the time, and there are benefits to that, but also costs. It's not great for our mental health that it's not possible to leave work, you know, that you have to set real limits that aren't always respected depending on where you work. I don't think it's always great to have all of human knowledge in a supercomputer in your pocket. Social media is sometimes great and sometimes a disaster. So there's a part of me that thinks that our interest in these works isn't really about apocalypse per se. It's more maybe some desire to live in a world that's less technological, you know, where there's a little bit more space and privacy and less tech.
Mm-hmm. Olive has this great statement or this thought that she has. She thinks, quote, as a species, we have a desire to believe that we're living at the climax of the story. It's a kind of narcissism, unquote. What do you think of Olive's belief?
Yeah, I think she's right. I think it is this kind of narcissism as a species that we want to believe we're living at the end of history, that at this particular moment, after all these millennia of false alarms, that now is finally truly the worst that it's ever been. And that does seem narcissistic to me, honestly. You know, this desire to believe we're living at the climax of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's such a great observation. That was one of many takeaways I had from the book. I just really thought that was bang on. And I figured it was your belief too, but right. You never know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I thought I'd ask. Emily St. John Mandel, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Sea of Tranquility. It's a beautifully written, thought-provoking book. And looking forward to your next book and the adaptations.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Emily St. John Mandel is the author of Sea of Tranquility. You can find out more about Emily and the Mandel Cinematic Universe at wpr.org/beta.
I tried to be very fair in the film and really showed that it wasn't Jay's fault. It wasn't Jeff's fault. They just happened to be two egos at that point, fueled by a lot of demons.
Coming up, Gorman Bouchard on his documentary, Where Are You, Jay Bennett? The film focuses on the former Wilco singer-songwriter, his musical legacy, and his infamous split with frontman Jeff Tweedy. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.